brought to you by Hug House Productions.
Welcome back to Nevermorph, the podcast in which I am forced to talk about whales. I did this to myself. I know. I am joined once more by C.N. Josephs. You'll hear me call him Noah. And I am urging you once more to give to the Palestinian Children's Relief Fund and to not stop talking about Palestine from the river to the sea. If you didn't listen to the last episode of Nevermorphed, be sure to go do that. This is the second of our three-part episode on this book that I did not like. And as always, you can find the audio in full as well as get early releases over on our Patreon.
So yeah, they're just straight up being shot with guns by the controllers. Nobody gets hit. That's good. They run to the water. So they run to the water because they don't know what else to do. And they're like, we'll morph and then we'll get out of here. They'll be looking for human footprints, but you won't see humans in the water because we'll be fishies. But the only fish morphs they have are trouts, which are freshwater fish. And
they're in the ocean, which is definitely not freshwater.
Definitely not. Like, this is not their worst plan. Everything in book three was their worst plan, hands down.
Yeah.
But, like, it's not one of their best.
No, but I also think this is one of those, like, what the fuck else would they have done? Like,
I know.
When they're actively being shot at. Like, and yeah. I kind of love, like, moments like this where, like, the kids are forced to take a morph that is not suited to, like, the environment they're in. And the book, like, really acknowledges that rather than just, like, brushing over it. Because it's so much more interesting to have the books acknowledge that, like, trout are freshwater fish and they do not do well in salt water than if they had just kind of tried to brush over that and be like, ah, they're fish, it's fine. Like, I love that this is not going well for them.
Yeah. And I love how much they fail. I love how much they fuck up. I love how much it's like they really could have died at any moment. And the reason they didn't was almost always luck. Because, like, that's real. That's so real.
Yeah.
Yeah, feels really real, feels really good. And also, I think that, especially because we've already gotten permanent consequences, in as much as Tobias being a forever hawk, which I know in book three, Rachel was like, the Andalites are coming back and they're going to turn you back into a real boy. And, like, first off, they did not fucking say that. They did not say that at all. Nobody has said that. No, not a single Andalite has said that that's a thing. They, if anything, they've been like, you have to be extremely careful because you'll turn into that morph forever. That seems fairly explicit to me. Two, I don't think the Andalites are coming back. So, but that's another conversation. I'll go back to the book at hand. So they morph into trouts. They hop into the water and it hurts and they can't breathe right. But, like, they're in there.
They're not getting shot at.
They're not getting shot at. They're not.
What kind of idiot would shoot a trout?
probably several. Fishing can be crazy. But regardless, they're not here to just shoot some trout. They're here to shoot some what they think are Andalites. So they're fine. And then at the shore, Tom and Chapman, both controllers, are talking to each other. They talk about, like, okay, human footprints, no humans in the water. And Tom brings up that, like, he doesn't think Visser 3 is right. That these, like, guerrilla fighters are Andalites. Tom thinks they're probably humans. And Chapman is like, yeah, 1,000,000%, but, like, I'm not gonna tell Visser 3 that.
I need to talk about this, okay? I have so many thoughts about this.
Yes, I laughed out loud.
Yes, yes, yes. I love this, both because it is just, like, genuinely so fucking funny that you're saying to unionize. but also because I feel like, to me, it actually brings up a point that I have also been picking up a lot in my Avatar rewatch, which is that ruling by fear works extremely effectively in the short term, but is always going to fail in the long term. Like, a thing that I have been noticing as I've been rewatching Avatar is that it is often surprisingly easy for the Gain and their allies to get Fire Nation soldiers and, like, Fire Nation allies to spill extremely confidential info by threatening them, because the loyalty the Fire Nation soldiers feel towards Azula and Ozai is driven by fear, and thus it can be overridden by giving them something scarier and more actively present. And, like, I feel like that came up so much in the Boiling Rock two-parter. First we see Sokka convincing Garth to release all of the prisoners just by convincing him that the Warden will be angry if he doesn't. And then there's everything with Mei and Ty Lee at the end of that episode. And I feel like this
one of my favorite moments.
I love that. Oh my god.
Yes.
I love the when Mei looks at Azula and says, "I love Zuko more than I fear you." And then a moment later when Azula and Mei start fighting, and then Ty Lee just the chi blocking on Azula, which I'm gonna say I've picked up on this watch through. I think that was both because of Ty Lee's love for Mei, but also because of her love of Zuko.
Love for Azula. I think Azula too.
Absolutely.
I think that she's like trying to protect Azula from what she is very obviously becoming. I love Ty Lee. Ty Lee is one of my absolute favorite characters.
I love Ty Lee. And there's this moment shortly before that in the episode where Azula is preparing to allow Zuko to fall into boiling lava. And if you look at Ty Lee's face, she looks really unsettled by this. And to me, this feels like the moment where she's realizing for the first time, like, oh my god, what has Azula become? What have I become that I'm helping her with this?
And also realizing, like, nothing is sacred to Azula. Nothing is more important than her power. Like, if she is willing to do this to Zuko, I know she's going to be willing to do it to me. I know she's going to be willing to do it to Mei. I know that she's going to be willing to do it to literally whoever, because it doesn't matter to her. Like, it's so good.
It's so good. And this is not an Avatar podcast yet, so we're going to I'm going to move away from that before we just like spend the next 15 minutes talking about Avatar. Yeah. But I wanted to bring that up because I think there's something similar happening here where, you know, if one of the Animorphs found out that Jake was wrong about something and that this was like a big important thing that was really going to impact their mission, they wouldn't hesitate to tell him.
Not even for a second. And he would be like, oh, cool, thank you. Yeah.
And like here we see that the Chapman and Tom Yerkes have information that would be so fucking useful for Visor 3 to have. If Visor 3 found out this information, he would be able to target his efforts to finding the alleged Andalite bandits much more effectively and would probably find them a lot sooner. But they are afraid of him. And afraid that he will strike them down just for telling him he's wrong, so they don't say anything. And I feel like that is honestly a key part of what allows the Animorphs to stay undercover for so long, is that
100%.
Everyone except Visor 3 is figuring this out, and everyone is too afraid to tell Visor 3.
God, I love Visor 3 so much. Oh, he's such a fun character. He's so bad at his job.
He's such like an Andalite fail girl to me.
Yes, exactly. He is very much poor little Meow Meow for me. He's so useless. He's so pathetic. I love him. I love him.
He sucks so bad.
So chapter 7, after they get back home, they go back home safe. A few days pass, which was very shocking to me, and kind of set up one of the recurring things of this book was, like, they were so gung-ho. Even Marco was like, we have to go, and we have to go now. And then it's been a few days. I was so taken aback, which we find out is, like, the point of what's going on in this chapter, because Jake comes over unexpectedly. Cassie is notably literally shoveling shit. She's so grimy. There is this interaction that they have where when he shows up, she's like, oh, thanks, did you come over here to help me shovel shit? And he goes, yeah, And she goes, okay. And so she lets him. It's, like, so cute. It's such a, like,
yeah,
like, funny little flirtation that they have. I love that he commits to the bit, and also that he's like, yeah, I'll help you. I'll show up. Yeah. What do you need?
Yeah.
Like, oh, yeah. So good. So good.
I love it also because I feel like it's established kind of, like, subtly, not, like, super overt, but, like, in a bit of a subtle way, that, like, Jake's family is definitely more, like, wealthy than Cassie's is. Mm. Like, they live in, like, this, like, a good house, like, a very nice neighborhood.
Yeah.
You know, and I just love that this is showing that, like, Jake does not necessarily see any kind of, like, class divide between them, and yeah, is perfectly happy, yeah, to just, like, put on overalls and start literally shoveling shit with Cassie. Like, he does, yeah, not in any way see himself as, like, above her. Like, he's just like, oh, no, you're working in the farm? Okay, I guess I'm working in the farm, too.
Yeah, it's so good. Oh, they're so good together. It's so cute. It's so cute. So they're shoveling shit. And as they're doing that, he's like, hey, so he's kind of waiting on what we should do about your dreams. Because if you think that they're definitely, like, real for real, we gotta go get the Andalite. And if you think, like, nah, that was weird how I had a dream, then we don't, or, like, we gotta figure out a plan. Tobias can't really be the one to make the decision, even though he's also having the dreams, because, like, he is a hawk forever, and he can't come into the ocean. So, like, probably we don't need to put the burden of this decision on his shoulders. And Cassie is like, I don't wanna. And, again, frustrates me. I absolutely see where she's coming from. But this is where that starts. Just important to say.
Yeah.
And Jake immediately is like, listen, if you make a decision, I'll back you. Like, I'll give you support. But it's not the support that is bothering her. It's that if she says, we have to go save this Andalite, she is automatically, by the nature of how things work for them, assigning them to go on a mission where they could totally die. And importantly, in the last book, they super almost did.
Like, yes, yes.
They were, like, close to dying. I mean, everybody at the end of it pretty much figured, like, well, let's go out with a bang and destroy the ship. It was only because they happened to fall out the right way and morph before they hit the ground. Like, it was a close call.
I just want to take a moment to acknowledge the moment in the previous book when the Animorphs who were trapped on the ship were basically like, hey, Tobias, we've decided that there's no way we're getting out of this, so we're just going to, like, kamikaze this and, like, go out with a bane and kill ourselves and blow up the ship while we're at it. And yeah, I was just sitting there like, these are middle schoolers and this is only book 3 out of, like, 50 something. And they're already willing to, like, kill themselves. And this is so, so unsettling.
And that's why I don't trust the Andalites. Well, there's, like, many reasons I don't trust the Andalites, but, like, this is one of them. Yeah. Crazy. That book is wild. So Cassie is saying, like, I don't really feel good about being the person who's going to be making the decision that might choose whether or not my friends die. And then eventually she's like, okay, like, we really do gotta go help, which means we're gonna have to get new morphs. And then the other sort of, like, Cassie philosophy that comes up in this book that I thought was really cool and I really did like, was her basically being worried about, like, the dolphins consenting to this.
Yeah, yeah.
Really interesting, because so dolphins are, like, very, very intelligent. We know this. And because they're so intelligent, like, I mean, she compares it, and I don't think that this comparison is apt at all. I can see where she's coming from, but I think that it's, like, I just don't think that the analogy works. She compares it to what the Yerks are doing to humans, of like, well, like, we're still like becoming them and controlling their bodies. Mm-hmm. It's not the body that they currently are inhabiting, but like that's their genetics, you know, like it's kind of fucked up. And I think that that's totally valid, especially like given dolphins are so intelligent, and it's freaky. That's freaky.
Yeah. Yeah. I love how often like Cassie in particular is one to just kind of like ruminate over like moral and philosophical issues.
Yes.
And I feel like it fits her character very well, I think, because she is this very like introspective person. And I think it also like makes sense that like she would be the one to bring this up, both because she is, you know, like we've established, such a like introspective person, and also just like, you know, both of her parents work in the animal care field. I think they are both like vets, just doing wildlife rehabilitation. Yeah. Her dad does the wildlife rehabilitation and her mom works at the zoo. Yeah. And so like she's grown up around animals, and I think does have like this very unique relationship with animals compared to what the other animorphs have, which I love. I just want to mention, I don't think we see them tons in this book, but we see them more in later books, and I really love Cassie's parents.
We got the briefest glimpse of her dad here, and I liked him a lot. Mm-hmm. I actually really, so far, Jake's parents are fine. They like exist. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Marco and Tobias have shit going on. Rachel's parents, I think, are written so well. Really fascinating. I care a lot about her mom, who is trying her very best.
There are so many parts in Rachel POV where, as a child of divorce, I am just like, oh, good God in heaven. I feel like I have been in this exact scenario before.
I really like how her mom is written. And I think that the way that her mom is written is so like feminist in a really genuine way, especially for the time.
Yeah.
It's very cool. Very cool. Not surprising coming from K.A. Applegate, but like still.
Yeah.
Good shit.
But I'm getting a bit off topic. So let's keep talking about dolphins.
Yes. So what do you think of dolphins, before we Will? Get. Oh, God. So.
I know you're not crazy about them. Uh-huh.
Yeah. So my scale of measuring whether or not an animal is big enough to scare the shit out of me is I measure it in how many dolphins it is. So if a creature is like 3 to 4 dolphins, it's on thin ice. If it's 4 to 5 dolphins, I am scared of it.
Thinking about those Americans will measure with anything but the metric system jokes.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, I growing up, instead of going to like Disneyland or anything, my family went to SeaWorld every year. First of all, just to be clear, right up front, fuck SeaWorld. Evil place.
Fuck SeaWorld.
Bad place.
Yeah.
Fuck SeaWorld. And we would always go like in December because it was like empty because it's freezing cold and you get wet on like every ride and like every experience. Nobody's there in December, which is why we went. And that meant that like usually we would do things like pet the dolphins because you'd have to pay for food, but like you wouldn't have to like wait in a line or anything. There was no people. You weren't having to like bump up against anybody. So we would go and pet the dolphins. And it was always fun.
Mm-hmm.
But I was always like, they're making fun of us.
The dolphins?
Yeah. Like, I don't know what it is. Dolphins have this energy about them. And like here in this book, it's like they're fun, they're playful. Yay, hooray. But I have always felt like dolphins are sarcastic little jackasses. So like I'm not scared of dolphins, but I don't trust them. We gotta talk about this last line of chapter 7 because it's so precious. I don't even have more commentary here. I just think it's darling. So Jake is like, okay, well anyway, I gotta peace out. I have homework to do. And Cassie is like, oh, you'd rather do homework than shovel shit with me here? And he says, and I'm quoting directly from the book here, Cassie, he said, I would rather shovel manure with you than do homework without you any day. It's so cute.
It's so cute.
I just love them.
I love them. I love everything about them. I love Jake. I feel like Jake is just such a, like, genuinely good guy who has been put into, like, such a shitty, shitty situation where he has to make so many horrible decisions. Yes. And I do feel so much sympathy for Jake in this entire series.
Yeah.
And I love him, and I love everything he has with Cassie and this adorable little, like, you know, middle school crush thing that they both have going on. It's just,
so cute.
I love them.
So chapter 8, the Animorphs go to the gardens for more morph DNA. And okay. Well, here, oh no, we're back at it.
Okay, can I say something about your notes here, Will?
Yeah.
So that was really interesting for me reading your notes, because my experience reading this chapter was that they kept talking about how awesome and cool and smart dolphins are. And your one of your first bullet points says, honestly, this chapter is a lot of talking about how fucked up dolphins are, followed by, okay, well, nobody seems to think everything about them is fucked up except me. I do. They're too smart. It's freaky. Bad.
Yeah. Yeah. But so they go to the gardens. They talk about how great dolphins are, I guess. They come across this trainer, Eileen, who is telling them all these things about the dolphins. And the dolphins are all named after Friends characters. This was another tick on the, like, man, this book could not be less for me. I hate Friends.
I do feel like it is also another tick in the, wow, these books are so 90s.
Oh, yes. Yes, absolutely. Which I did love that. I hate being confronted with the memory of Friends. So as they're there, Cassie brings up this philosophical debate about how is what they're doing any different from what the Yerkes do? And again, like, I don't feel like this analogy actually works at all. However, I think that it was a very effective way of conveying the root of the conversation to the other kids and to the audience, because I think that the root of the conversation isn't really about, like, taking a body over and controlling it. I think that the conversation is about consent. And I don't think that we certainly were not having the nuanced conversations about consent that we are now. And I think that this is just, you know, like, I think that had these books been written now, they probably would have talked about consent using that word. But I do think that this is, like, a really interesting thought and premise of discussion for this chapter. So Rachel does point out why the premise is flawed, and Cassie keeps trying to poke holes on it. But again, it's really more about, like, the consent versus, like, the practicality of what's going on. They just kind of, like, have that discussion. And then Cassie has this passage, and my note here is just, Cassie, you are projecting, which is not a judgment. It is more just like, girl, I feel you. She says about the dolphins, just watching them makes you happy. It also makes you feel like you're this clunky, awkward wind-up toy, jerky and stumbling and clumsy. Human beings may be the smartest creatures on Earth, but we sure are dorky compared to a lot of other species. And I think that this relates a lot to, like, Cassie's vision of herself as this, like, kind of messy, sloppy, grimy, like, she doesn't care about her appearance. You know, she would put on a dress for a picture if Jake wanted it. She would have to borrow it from Rachel, but, like, she knows that she would, like, quote unquote, should strive for that, but she doesn't. I just thought this was, like, really good insight into how Cassie thinks. I just really liked it.
I feel like there's also, I don't feel super equipped to, like, have this analysis. I feel like this is something that would be, that would benefit more from having the perspective of, like, a Black queer person. But I feel like there could definitely be a reading of Cassie as, like, a baby Butch.
Oh, yeah!
Just with, like, her, like, discomfort around wearing, like, of dresses and like not her discomfort with like traditionally feminine things. But again, I do think that like, you know, for me, like as a white butch, I can definitely see like some of my own experiences in Cassie. Yeah. But I also know that like there's a lot of nuance that needs to be had with, yes, you know, Black characters and the way that like Black women, both in real life and in media, are often denied femininity even if they want, yes, it. Yes. And so again, I don't feel this isn't something that I feel really confident to like dive super deep into. But I just wanted to observe that like it is something that like I do find myself relating to a bit.
Totally.
It's just like this discomfort with femininity that Cassie has, but also her, like you were saying, her feeling like she should be doing these things, but she just can't bring herself to actually care about them enough to do them.
Yeah.
I also want to make one more comment about the like consent conversation with the dolphins that, yeah, I think is interesting, yeah, which is that this topic about like consent with Morphane, again, not necessarily using the word consent, but like you were saying, right, I think that is like what they are ultimately discussing here. It is a conversation that comes up throughout the series, but usually talking about like morphing like humans. And so I feel like Cassie bringing it up about dolphins does kind of also emphasize that Cassie, who feels very close to animals, does not see the division between human and non-human animals as being as firm as the other animorphs do.
Oh, yeah. I didn't even think about that, because the only time we've had somebody morph into a human that they have seen is at the very end of this book, which we'll get to. I didn't even think of that, of setting up that, mm-hmm, connection and that discussion leading to that moment where we see it for the first time. That's fascinating.
Yeah.
Good work.
Yeah, yeah, hey, right?
Applegate. Fuck yeah.
Right?
Oh, these books are so good.
Right? Like, genuinely, these books are really, really well written. Like,
yeah.
I really, really love them. Like, very genuinely.
Yeah, they're so fucking good. I've been like proselytizing to people, being like, you gotta read these books. Like,
yeah, yeah.
I'm only four in. It's so good. They're so good. Okay. So, okay. They do get the DNA for the morph. Mm-hmm. And then chapter 9, they go up to the river, and the river empties into the ocean. So, mm-hmm, their plan is that Tobias will fly above and he'll be the timekeeper. Rachel put a timer on his little bird leg, and he'll make sure that they are under 2 hours.
Yeah.
They're going to morph in the river and then swim, mm-hmm, quickly to the ocean. That way, mm-hmm, they won't have to deal with all of the controllers who are already at the beach. They can just, yeah, slip right in, which I think is very clever.
Yeah. I really love one of the like consistent things in this series of the issues that arise from the fact that, like, you know, they cannot go from one morph to another morph. They have to be human in between, and all, yes, the issues that arrive from just like, okay, how do we morph close enough to get to where we need to go, get where we need to go, but far away enough that no one will see us morph from human to this morph and then be able to know exactly who we fucking are. Particularly, right, given that there, right, are so many there are at least two controllers who would recognize them by sight.
Right, and who are probably already looking for humans instead of androids. Yeah.
Uh-huh. And I do feel like, you know, both Tom and Chapman's hesitance over telling Visser 3, like, hey, I think these Andalite bandits are humans, would disappear if they could say, hey, I have this specific human who is definitely the, yeah.
1,000,000%. Yeah. Yeah, yeah, yeah. So they get into the ocean, but they're in dolphin brain and they just want to play. So they're in the, mm-hmm, water and they're playing and they're having so much fun and they're playing and they're having so much fun and they're playing. And Tobias is like, hi, it's been 45 minutes. Amazing. Honestly, glad they got some time to decompress.
They fucking needed it. Also, I can't judge them. How many times, Will, have you been playing a video game and you're like, I've probably been playing for like 10 minutes. And then someone comes in and is like, hey, you've been in here alone for 3 hours. So they wasted 45 minutes.
They wasted 45 minutes and there's a shark.
And that's not good.
And that's not good. And then what's even worse is then we get to chapter 11.
I love your really in-depth notes here.
Yeah. So my notes, this is where I just say I don't like it. So I was really scared. I was really, really scared. So
yeah.
To my memory, what happens is they fight off the shark. Marco's tail is bitten really bad. He is like gonna fucking die if they don't morph. And then a big whale comes and saves them. It like swims over to them and helps them.
I know. And you hate it. Could I read a little Rachel and Tobias exchange from chapter 11?
Yes.
"You guys do what you want," Rachel said. "I'm going in." "Oh, there's a big surprise," Tobias said with weary affection.
Oh. That's so good. God, I love Rachel.
Right?
Yeah. Yeah. So, so the whale saves them and like, yay, that's great. That's great. That's great. Chapter 12, Marco's tail, in my notes, I write, was bites off and he dying. Yeah.
That's about it. Yeah.
That's about it. So, and then, oh God, he makes this comment of like, "Fuck, I can't do this, guys. My mom died because she drowned. I can't die here. My dad, my dad." Oh, so fucked up. So
I know. Poor Marco.
Cassie is brilliant. She's like, "Listen, DNA doesn't carry injuries."
Yeah.
I had been waiting to see if this was a thing. So she says, "Turn back into a human. Then you can turn back into a dolphin. And we'll see if the injury carried. If it didn't, that's chill. We're fine. If it did, we're probably fucked. We'll figure it out." So Marco is going to do that. And then the whale does come to help them. What was happening in chapter 11 then?
I think chapter 11 was just talking about like the whale being nearby. And I think that was just enough for you to like.
Oh, yeah. No, I think that I actually hate when a whale is nearby and approaching more than I hate a whale being present.
Okay, so chapter 11 was they realized that there was a humpback whale nearby that was being attacked by sharks. I'm sorry.
Right. And the sharks just did not do a good enough job.
Yeah. And and the other animorphs are like, "Let's go help the whale."
Oh, that's right. Ugh.
And you hate it.
I hate it. I'm glad they did it because it comes in clutch later, but.
Yeah.
So on the back of this whale, Marco is going to shift back into human, which is good because he can't. Oh, he also can't swim. It's just a fucking nightmare. As Marco does that, Cassie has a truly fucking cool experience. She like mind melds with the whale, and it's literally like she is tripping to the point where she's like inside of God's mind. It's pretty sick.
Yeah, it's like. Whatever, like, the opposite end of the scale is that, like, cosmic horror is at one scale. This is, like, cosmic un-horror?
Cosmic bliss? Serenity, we'll say. Cosmic serenity,
yeah.
Yeah. It's really beautiful. It really genuinely does kind of feel like my friends who have, like, done mushrooms, done acid. Like, it sounds pretty similar. But it's just like she's learning this whale's whole life and story. And it's, but there's this like sense of gravity and like deep understanding of the universe. It's very cool.
I honestly really love this. It's still scary. Yeah. To you.
To me. Sorry, to me specifically.
Like, I feel like came off like ruder, but,
So in this beautiful mind meld with God, the whale also shows her where the Andalite is. He's like, oh yeah, you're looking for that guy? I know where the fuck that guy is. He's that fucking little weirdo. He's not supposed to be here. And the whale shows her this meadow. This meadow that's fully underwater. And it has an Andalite. And she's like, oh shit, yeah, that's probably him. Not a whole that's lot of guys who look like that. So she has a location. But they have like 25 minutes left in this morph. So they need to go home. And then it just kind of skips. And then chapter 13, they're back home. Yeah. And I said, this seems so silly and unnecessary to me. I guess Marco did almost like fully just die. So
yeah,
there's that.
I do also want to note that like it is established, I think by this point in the series, I don't know how much it has come up at this point, that the experience of morphing and demorphing is like very physically taxing. And the more they have to switch between morphs, like the more physically fatigued they get. Mm-hmm. And so I can definitely see like the argument for them, you know, because like you said, they had like 25 minutes left in morph. Even if they did decide, you know, even if Marco was like, I'm fine, let's just do it, they would have had to like morph back to human, morph back to dolphin, get to the meadow, morph back to human again to be in the meadow, then morph back to dolphin to leave. I think it would have just been too much for them to be able to do all of that and still be able to fight if someone came to fuck with them, which of course someone is going to, because of course.
Yeah.
Nothing ever goes right for the Animorphs.
Like, as we learn, there's no way that they could even get to where he is in that amount of time, which we'll get to in a second. I think I just, again, this is the Rachel and me being like, we gotta do it now.
God, I do feel like, I feel like the crux of our friendship really is that you are very much a Rachel and I am very much a Cassie.
That is so accurate. Yeah.
And I feel
just
like
in the books, it works.
Yeah, I feel like that is both like why we disagree with each other, honestly, a fair amount. I think there's plenty of things we do disagree with each other on.
Oh,
but also, like, we work together really well.
Yeah, and we like, we actually talked about this before we recorded. Because we had such different like feelings on the book, is like when we disagree with each other, it's like still cool as hell. If anything, I find that I learn a lot more talking with you. It's like I'm always excited to talk to you about things that we disagree on. Like, even though I know that probably my perspective won't change, I just learn so much. It's just very nice. Yeah. I really like it.
I really like it too. And, you know, I think it is really good for people to like have an experience of like having a civil conversation with someone who they disagree with. I think more people should open themselves up to that, to be frank.
Yes. Oh my God. Seriously.
I like feel bad saying this because I feel like it's such a like conservative talking point, but I do genuinely feel like a lot of like leftist spaces have become these very insular bubbles where like anyone who disagrees even slightly is like excommunicated from the flock, if you will.
Yes.
And I really
one thing you and I agree on is that we're both abolitionists.
Yes.
So we don't fuck with that.
We do not. That is something we both agree on, like, very, very firmly. I think that, like, there are...
Yes.
I honestly think that politically, overall, you and I tend to be, like, very closely in agreement. I think if there may be points where, like, we disagree on, like, the most effective, like, way to implement things, but I think our core beliefs are very closely in alignment.
Absolutely agreed. And I think that, like, you know, like you said, like, we might have differences in, like, prioritization or in implementation. And what I think is really, like, vitally important is that, like, you need people who disagree about those things to make sure that when things are implemented, when we are accounting for things politically, we're not getting too ahead of ourselves. You know, we're keeping ourselves in balance. We're keeping ourselves in check. If I were in this situation with trying to just go save this Andalite, I would be like, let's just fucking go. Let's just fucking do it. And I would have gotten us killed. Like,
Absolutely.
Straight up. Yeah.
Yeah. And I get that. Cause like, you know, I, I have a tendency to kind of like rush into things. And like a thing that Nick and I were talking about last night is that Nick is the type of person who, like, as soon as you bring up even like a vague plan, like immediately they are thinking through like, okay, well, how is this going to work? Here's a possible issue. Here's a possible issue. Here.
That's how I do too.
How are we going to solve all of this? Yeah.
Yep.
And like, it drives me crazy sometimes, but also like, I know that it is like, it is great. And I think that ultimately like it balances out my impulsivity really well.
Yeah. Yes. Yes.
But also I think that like my impulsivity can balance Nick out and like prevent Nick from getting too bogged down in the details and get Nick to the point where because sometimes you have to stop thinking and just do it, right? Sometimes you need to stop strategizing, stop planning and just fucking do the thing. Just
do it. And right.
I think it is really good to have that balance of people who are like thinkers who poke holes in everything and people who are like, okay, we've talked about this enough. Let's just do it.
Yep.
And
absolutely.
I do think that is really vital in any kind of interpersonal relationship, both on a smaller scale and a larger societal scale.
Absolutely. 100% agreed. See, we agree on the important shit.
We agree on this, yeah. I predict that at least once an episode, every episode that I'm on, we are going to get sidetracked at some point by just like a political discussion.
1,000,000%. That's what these books are for.
Yeah, absolutely.
So they go back home and Cassie, this is the chapter that really bothered me with Cassie.
And this is a chapter that I really loved with Cassie. So yeah, I think this is like so fascinating.
I'm excited. So she goes to Marco to talk about the day before when Marco literally almost fucking died. And she is like, she just keeps saying like, I'm so sorry. I can't believe I made a choice and you got hurt. And like that is so difficult for me to deal with. And Marco is like, it's literally chill. Like, yeah, I know what I signed up for. We all signed up to potentially die all the time. It would have sucked. It wouldn't have been your fault. Like, chill. And Cassie is like, no. Me, it's my responsibility. I'm so sorry. And like, I did not like this. I did not like this one bit. It just felt very uncharacteristically selfish and frankly inconsiderate for Cassie, which I don't know if it necessarily felt out of character for her, because this is really the first time I'm getting this side of her, but it did feel very off from what I expected of her, which is unfair, and especially unfair given the circumstances. But yeah, it really bothered me. I didn't like it. Well written, frustrated me.
And that's really interesting to me, because I think I had like a completely different understanding of the chapter. Like, all of it very much felt to me like not like Cassie trying to like make this thing that happened to Marco about herself, but rather Cassie approaching Marco about a horrible thing that they went through together and trying to like talk through that with him as someone who also experienced it. Because, you know, I do think that like the experience of watching somebody almost die is in and of itself traumatic. And I think you could definitely make an argument here about like, oh, what's that thing called? Like silk ring theory?
See, that's where my brain goes to. Yeah. Like, maybe don't talk to Marco about this, because he is ultimately the one who almost died. You know, like probably go talk to like Jake about this, or like Tobias maybe.
Yeah. I think where we kind of diverge here is, for me, I think when you are discussing matters of like trauma and mental health and everything like that, I think there can be a point where it can be helpful to just kind of step away from like theories and how you're supposed to do things, and just like have a raw, messy, open conversation with someone who went through something really scary with you, even if that's not what you're like quote unquote supposed to do in the situation. And so like, I really liked this chapter because it did very much feel to me like just like Cassie and Marco like having this conversation about something they went through together. And so I really liked it. I do see where you're coming from. I think this is just one of those things that we do, you know, like we were saying, we don't always agree on everything. And I think this is just one of those things where like, we're viewing the same thing from very different angles.
Totally. I think for me, what would have made this work is if she had like asked him if this was okay to talk about before they launched into it. And then when he kept pushing back and being like, I don't like, please stop, you know, that like mm-hmm. she would have. I think that that would have made it feel a lot better to me. But I also think, one, we don't have the time for that in a book this small. Two, it would have been, first off, like anachronistically therapy speak. And yeah, and like three, again, like they're children.
Yeah. I do think it is important to keep in mind the context of both when these books were written, when they're set, and how old the characters are. Because I do think if you took this entire scene verbatim, but changed it so that A, the characters were older, and B, it was set in like the 2020s, I think my perspective on it would be different.
Yeah.
But I think given like both like A, where conversations about like trauma and mental health were at this time, and also fact that these kids are fucking children, like it works for me. Like it's flawed and it's messy, but in a way that really works for me, in a way that does leave me feeling sympathetic about both of them. And I do love that moment in the chapter where Marco says, so was I afraid yesterday? Bet on it. I was scared plenty. It was like, man, it's not bad enough we have to fight Hork-Bajir and Taxons and Visor 3. We also have to fight sharks? Sharks? He laughed, and hearing him brought the laughter out of me. We both just stood there and giggled like idiots for a few minutes. It was that laughter you get after something really tense has happened. Relief laughter. We're still alive laughter. And I think that is a really critical moment in the scene for me, because I think to me, at least to me, that, and I'm totally welcome to hear if you disagree with this, I think at least to me, that communicates that while Marco may be a bit frustrated, he ultimately is not necessarily mad at Cassie for bringing this up, and is trying to like, realizes that like some tension has built up between them over the course of the scene and is now intentionally trying to diffuse that tension.
Yeah, I could see that totally.
Yeah. And I really like that. I feel like Marco, you know, often will get reduced to just like the funny guy, but I do feel like he has a very genuine skill for like figuring out how to diffuse tension, which I think is really, really critical with everything these kids are going through.
Absolutely. I can't wait for the Marco book. I'm so excited. I'm going to start reading it like sometime this week. Yeah, I'm stoked. Yeah. So after this all, they talk about how there are controllers that are searching the ocean and they're making up cover stories in the news. They don't really matter. It's fine. But in chapter 14, they regroup at Rachel's house to formulate a new plan with all of this new information that they've gleaned from this first little experience. So using the confusing but good data that Cassie now has, they sort of formulate where in the ocean this Andalite is, and it's way too far for them to be able to swim there in 2 hours. There's no fucking way. Yeah. So their new plan, and this is a plan that I think is really solid and really cool and really fun, is they're going to get seagull DNA, morph into seagulls, find a controller ship that's going in the direction they need to go to because they're all looking for the same thing, ultimately, camp out unmorphed as, like, humans on the ship until they're around the area, and then hop off the side, turn into dolphins, and swim the rest of the way there. They're just going to take a little taxi. This is brilliant. This is a good plan.
Yeah.
Like, this seems very fun. It seems like a very fun plan. Yeah. I love they just get to hang out for a while.
Right? I love when, like, I feel like we so often see the characters just kind of being forced to like rush into a situation and come up with a last minute plan that falls apart. And I really love these moments we get sometimes where like they have enough time to really think about a plan and they manage to come up with something that is genuinely very clever.
Yes. Yes. Yeah. Has not. I'm really soured on their plan making ability from book three because Jesus Christ. But
oh my god, that went so bad.
So bad. And then we'll just get Tobias to airlift us to the lake as fish. Oh my god. Anyway, yes, this is a very good plan. Very proud of them. Very proud of my babies. Jake is reminding them, like, we gotta go. oh, we gotta go. This is urgent. We gotta go. As they're talking about this, Cassie almost tells Jake she likes him. But instead, she turns and she tells him instead to never get hurt. And at that moment, I was like, Jake is gonna be shreds at the end of this book. Like, he's gonna get so fucking hurt. Did not happen. We've still got time, though. There's plenty of books for him to get hurt. Yep. Noah's giving me a big thumbs up and a big no talking on video. So, chapter 15, they morph into seagulls. And they just get really distracted by food. Otherwise, they're fine. At one point, oh, Tobias has this moment that's so good. They're like, oh, I see a ship coming this way. And he's like, oh, you just saw that. Wow, that's really cute. Because he has these hawk eyes that are just incredible. And they're like, uh-huh. Oh, show off. And he's like, yeah, want to know what color the captain's hat is? Because I can see that. I can. And like, I love this for him. He does not get a lot of moments where like he gets to gloat about being a forever hawk.
Yeah, yeah. I feel like this book is really interesting for me because it's, you know, the first book we get after book three. And so I feel like this is the first book where, like, from the beginning of the book, Tobias has kind of accepted, like, his life as a hawk. And it's really interesting seeing the shift in him from the previous book to this book.
Absolutely. He's so much more confident in this book. He has, like, a few moments where he's a little down, for sure.
Yeah.
But he seems a lot more settled in himself, which is really, it's very heartening. So, the ship. Okay. Here is another thing. And don't answer me on this. I keep switching which coast I think this takes place on. It is the least interesting thing for me to have, like, theories about, but I can't shake it from my head. So, this ship is either coming to or coming from, I don't remember, Monrovia. And there's two Monrovias. One of them is in California, and the other is in Liberia. So it really kind of could go either way here. I'm going to put this as another vote for West Coast for myself. But it could be Liberia.
For reference, I just pulled up this. So yeah. The ship is called Numar, and it is from Monrovia.
From Monrovia. So it could be. It could be from here in California. I say here. I don't know if the books take place in California. Also, I am not in California. But
you are as far from California as you can be while still being in the U.S.
Yeah. Yeah. Straight up. So they get on the ship and they land and they hang out there as humans. They're in their morph suits, which are like super tight fitting, like nothing-y clothes. So they're really cold. Marco is declaring, like, I want a cool uniform that is warm. This, admittedly, was a vote for it being on the East Coast because it really doesn't get that cold in California. On ships, it can, especially in the winter. But, like, if you're thinking about winter, that really is an East Coast thing. We don't really get winter out west, at least not in the Southwest. And they're trying to do math to figure out how they're close to the right area. I read this and I know that there was information within it, but it made no sense to me. They did some kind of math. That's cool. And they realize that they're close. So they go to the side of the ship and they're like, oh, the ship is really high up. what are we gonna do? So they're like, well, if we jump off, you know, we'll morph maybe like in transit when we're in the air, or maybe we'll morph in the water if we can survive that far of a drop. But again, Marco can't swim, so he has to morph 100% before he hits the water, and this is an issue because they don't know what to do. Marco says that he'll just start he'll start morphing and they can just push him over. But dolphins weigh like a fucking lot. And they all look to Cassie to be like, what do we do? And Cassie flails around making a decision. And then Marco is just like, yeah, I'm not waiting on this. And he just starts morphing.
For reference, an adult bottlenose dolphin can weigh like 300 to 1400 pounds, according to Google.
Oh my god. So yeah, this is like good fucking luck, guys. I just thought it was so funny that he's just like, yeah, no, what? I'm not waiting.
Let's just do it.
Yeah. Luckily, they flop him over, he gets into the water. The rest of them get into the water. The waves are making it really hard to breathe. This passage was very scary, not in the whale way, but in just like a good like writing suspense way, with them being dropping into the water, getting hit with the waves from the ship, struggling to breathe, struggling to surface, trying to morph during this time. Really suspenseful. Really good writing here. And then it makes the contrast for when Cassie finalizes into her morph as a dolphin just so much – the contrast is just so much more stark because she immediately is completely comfortable, completely at peace, in a great mood. The waves mean nothing to her. Like, just again, just really fucking good writing here.
Yeah. I grew up in Seattle, right?
Yeah.
So like I grew up on the Puget Sound, which is an inlet from the Pacific Ocean. I, you know, used to take camping trips out on like the coast of Washington mm-hmm. as a kid. I grew up swimming a lot is what I'm saying. And I would say I have a very healthy respect for the ocean. And I think a healthy yes. respect for the ocean inherently includes a little bit of fear.
Yes, correct.
And so like I'm not necessarily like afraid to go swimming. I do always have like a little bit of fear in the back of my head that I'm going to drown, which yeah. I think is healthy, to be honest. I think you yeah, should be aware of that possibility at all times if you're going to swim in the ocean. And there are, you know, moments throughout the series like this where we see the kids having to, you know, morph an aquatic animal and due to the nature of aquatic animals, get into the water before they start morphing.
Yeah.
And when the water is rough and choppy, it is just always so like viscerally written in a way that like really deeply unsettles me, but in like a really good way.
I wonder if K.A. Applegate, like, I wonder what her relationship to the water is, like to the ocean is. I'd be very curious.
I would be as well. I just love how these books are written overall. I feel like they do a great yeah. job of being like really evocative.
Yes, very evocative. That is precisely the word that I would use for how these books are written.
Yeah. I think it can be hard to, like, write. I feel like a thing that a lot of writers struggle with is finding the balance between either writing that is just, like, so plain and straightforward that, like, it's hard to get into it, or writing that is, like, so deeply evocative it goes into, like, purple prose territory.
Yes.
And I feel like, to me, the sweet spot that I think K.A. Applegate, and also in a completely different way, George R. R. Martin actually managed to hit, is, like, managing to, like, figure out exactly how to nail that middle ground, and also specifically when there are sections that do benefit from more just, like, plain, straightforward writing, but also sections that benefit from a shift to much more, like, evocative feelings-based writing. And I think yes. that she does that really, really well.
So well, like thinking about the only times that she gets even close to something like purple prose is when we have moments of like Cassie mind melding with God. And like straight up, I think that that's a moment that you really need to employ something like that. Oh, you yeah. know, like
absolutely.
She knows exactly which scenes need exactly which methods of writing. It's really yeah. really impressive work. As they are in this like choppy water and resurfacing for air and trying to morph, they also see a helicopter flying over. And this is important because it's dragging a cable with a sensor through the water. And this is definitely a controller. This will come back later, but just they are being, the water is being monitored in this area.
Nevermorphed is hosted, edited, and produced by Will Williams. Our theme music is The Chase by Joey Hendrix. Our title is by Eddie Feely, and this podcast would not exist without Mike Schubert's podcast, Potterless and the Newest Olympian. You can find his works at shub.es, that's shub.es. Nevermorphed is a proud member of Hug House Productions. You can find more at hughouse.productions and follow us on Tumblr at Nevermorphed. Get morphin'!